Oh, good. Okay. The topic for tonight is Mordechai Kaplan. And one can view Mordechai Kaplan as a hero or as a villain. If this were a Reconstructionist shul, he'd be our idol. He'd be our founding father. And if even in a conservative or reform synagogue, he might be viewed in favorable light. But this being an Orthodox shul, we're going to see him through the eyes of him being a villain. And the key work on this topic, not of his whole career, but just his relationship with Orthodoxy and his departure from it, was written by my professor Jeffrey Gurak and Rabbi J.J. Schachter, A Modern Heretic and a Traditional Community. Came out about 1998.
Would we refer to him as an apikoros?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mordechai Kaplan was the greatest Kiruv professional of the 20th century and the greatest apikoros of the 20th century, all rolled into one.
The greatest Kiruv
professional. I would argue that. Okay. Mordechai Kaplan was born in 1881 in Lithuania. Comes to the United States when he is 8 years old in 1889. His father, Rabbi Israel Kaplan, gets a job as a dayan on the Beis Din of Chief Rabbi Jacob Joseph. So that tells you right away that Mordechai Kaplan grows up in a religious environment. And you would expect if his father was an old world rabbi, a product of Volozhin, and functioning as a dayan, that the son, Mordechai, would receive a thoroughly traditional education and would not be exposed to heretical influence. But you'd be wrong if you thought that. Because in fact, Israel Kaplan was more open-minded than your typical dayan. He was not averse to exposing his children, and for that matter himself, to Maskilic literature. And he even had Arnold Ehrlich, a former apostate who cooperated with Franz Delitzsch on the Hebrew translation of the New Testament, the Hebrew translation of the New Testament in 1877. Arnold Ehrlich was a close friend of Israel Kaplan and taught Mordechai in their home when he was a young boy. So you wouldn't have a meshumed teaching your son if you were a close-minded old world rabbi. I don't know.
He was straight.
He was a straight-laced traditional rabbi, yes.
Was he aware of all?
Probably not.
He would never stop.
No. Okay, so where does Kaplan go to school? For a little while, he goes to Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, which is today known as Yeshiva University. Okay, so when Yeshiva University says they were founded in 1886, it's Baba Maisa. It was founded really in 1915. The MTA was, and then the college in 1928, and university status in 1946. But Yeshiva Eitz Chaim on the Lower East Side was founded in 1886, and that morphed into Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary in 1897. So Art Kaplan is a student there briefly, but doesn't like it. And even though his father is a dayan in the Court of Jacob Joseph, which is the Association of American Orthodox Hebrew Congregations, which is five shuls on the Lower East Side, and Eitz Chaim is their crown jewel, their educational institution, still, if it isn't good, you don't send your kid there. So he went to public school. Starting in 1894, he goes to Jewish Theological Seminary. He's a 13-year-old boy, and he's in the sub-freshman class at JTS. What purpose does that serve? Well, simultaneously, he's also going to go to college. He goes to City College, and then he eventually gets a master's degree from Columbia. He's a young boy. He's a teenager. He's going to high school and then college. He graduates college at 19, and he graduates the seminary at 21.
JTS was
there for 8 years. It wasn't just for postgraduate rabbinics training. It was for teenage boys. So what was the status of JTS in those days? That's the question. And would a man like Rabbi Israel Kaplan be criticized for sending his young son to an institution like the seminary? Well, the answer is that the people in downtown on the Lower East Side were of mixed opinion about JTS. There were those moderate traditionalists who did not object to the seminary and, in fact, were financially backing the seminary despite its diverse faculty. Some of the faculty were bona fide Orthodox Jews, like Sabato Moraes, the Chazan of Philadelphia, of Mikveh Israel, or for that matter, Bernard Drachman. But there were other faculty members who were clearly not Orthodox, like Rabbi Joshua Jaffe or Alexander Kohut, who were moderate reformers, what today we might call conservative. So it was a mixed bag theologically on the faculty, and was it appropriate? This was before Schechter. But Schechter arrives on the scene in 1902, having been brought there by Jacob Schiff, when the seminary was reorganized because it was bankrupt. And he saves it, Schechter. But in the pre-Schechter seminary, you had young kids coming to learn. And what were they learning? Well, it was a mediocre religious education. Kaplan complained in his diary that he was disappointed on the day of the interview, you know, the Bechina. You go for the Smicha Bechina, for entrance exam, you expect to be challenged. After all, he'd been learning Gemara with his father, with Rishonim, with Rashi Tosfos, for a few years already. He thinks he's a real Lamdan. I mean, whether he is or he isn't, he thinks he is. And they ask him very simple, elementary questions about Chumash and Rashi in the entrance exam. So he knows right away this is not going to be a very rigorous Judaic education.
What other parallel types of religious educational institutions were there at the time?
Okay, so there are other Jewish theological seminaries elsewhere in the world. For example, in Breslau, which was the original one founded by Zachariah Frankel, but that was a more serious institution because it was in Germany and there were learned Jews in Germany. There was also one in Vienna. There was also one in Budapest. These were not yeshivas, but theological seminaries, which are places for rabbinic training, which are of the more academic variety and not the classical yeshiva style. But in New York, there was nothing. You have Reitz opens up in 1897, which is an old world yeshiva transplanted into New York. But other than the seminary in 1894, there's nothing.
So this was the only crap game in town.
Yes, yes, other than the elementary school of Eitz Chaim. Okay, so he goes there, he's learning, he's not especially satisfied, but he's learning the tricks of the trade. He's learning how to be an American rabbi, which is very important, because the old world rabbis are not satisfactorily catering to the interests of the Americanizing community. They just know how to give histrionics in Yiddish, but they don't know how to give an English language sermon to satisfy the audience in the pews. And people are leaving the pews in significant numbers. Second-generation Jews, those who were born to the immigrants who came early in the 1880s, 1890s, are being, you know, disaffected from synagogue life. So it's the job of the graduates of the seminary to bring them back into the communal orbit. But Kaplan will learn how to do this, and he'll be very successful at it. Okay. He graduates in 1902. Upon graduation, is he a rabbi? No, no, he's not a rabbi. He may be regarded by some as a rabbi, but he has a diploma from the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is not the same as smicha. It's not rabbinic ordination. It's not hatarat hora'ah, yora yora, or certainly not yadin yadin. So that you would only get from an individual rav who would confer it upon someone. So did the students of the old JTS get real smicha? The answer is some of them did and most of them didn't. Those who did studied privately with the old world rabbonim, whether from the Norfolk Street Synagogue, the Beis Medrash HaGadol. He could but didn't. He learned with his father, but it's better to get from someone else. Now, he would eventually get it from Rabbi Yaakov, Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. Rabbi Reines was the founder of Mizrahi. And wait a second, Rabbi Reines is in Poland. And Mordechai Kaplan is in New York. So how does he get the smicha? The answer is, in 1908, when he's 27 years old and he's on his honeymoon after having gotten married at a fairly late age for a would-be rabbi, he goes off to Poland on his honeymoon. He doesn't go to Hawaii or Tahiti. He goes to Poland. And he goes to Rabbi Reines. And Rav Reines asks him a couple of perfunctory questions in Shas and Poskim and gives him the smicha without asking too many questions about matters of theology or personal belief, which, to be fair to Rav Reines, neither does Rabbi Lamb when I got smicha in 2006. He didn't ask me any questions. He just shook my hand and said, Yesh Koyach, you know. So, but that's into the future. And we'll see the problem with that smicha soon enough.
Was that the type of smicha that Rav Reines gave to everybody, or he made...
No. It was a type of thing that would happen if you were an American whose father was a friend of yours, and it was just an issue of rubber stamping.
Politically
connected, yeah.
Was he considered a member of the clergy?
Yes, absolutely. So, in 1902, from 1900 to 1902, under the leadership of Bernard Drachman, who was his professor at JTS, and the rabbi of Zichron Ephraim on 67th Street, Kaplan and a few of his colleagues established the Jewish Endeavor Society. The Jewish Endeavor Society was a way of bringing young people into shul on Shabbos for a traditional service, which means with separate seating and a traditional liturgy, and including a significant amount of Hebrew language prayers, but in a way that would make them happy. In other words, no Yiddish, no commercialization of the synagogue, so no schnuttering. If you want a mishaberach, you just say the mishaberach. It doesn't have to be, you have to cough up money. And
sounds like young Israel.
Okay. So the Young Israel was established 10 years later as a successor to the Jewish Endeavor Society, but including the same people involved, with Mordechai Kaplan playing a nominal role at that time.
He was a speaker at their forum.
Friday Night Forum. Okay. So the Endeavor Society was Saturday afternoon, on the assumption that you had other things to do Saturday morning, not especially Jewish things, like going to play ball or to the movies or whatever, but Saturday afternoon you could go to a decorous service that had English language speeches and was aesthetically appealing. That was the idea of the Endeavor Society. The Young Israel originally was the Friday night lecture series on the assumption that maybe you were busy Saturday, but Friday night you were available. Same concept, appealing to a similar audience. Okay. 1903... Kaplan is looking for work, and he gets invited for a tryout at Kehilat Jetron, East 85th Street, okay? The most significant and prestigious Orthodox synagogue in Manhattan at that time. Why was there an opening? Because the Reverend Pikus, who was the previous Rebbe, he was fired. He was given the gold watch. He was fired, but they did it in such a way as to make it seem as though he wasn't fired. And they had a lavish kiddush in his honor, gave him a check for $500 and said, get lost. Why? Because he didn't speak well in English, or really at all in English. And the one time he tried to speak in English, some kid, a little prankster, took the index cards and reshuffled them, and the guy didn't know what he was saying. So... Under the circumstances, they were looking for a new clergyman. Now, when KJ was looking, they had two criteria. One, you have to be a real rabbi, real smicha. So none of this seminary diploma business. The other thing is, you have to be an effective American clergyman, which means speaking in English and catering to the children of immigrants, which the old world rabbis really couldn't do. So, Kaplan comes for a tryout, Parshas Vayeshev, 1903. And he wows the crowd. And they hire him, even though he doesn't have smicha. So, because he doesn't have smicha... No, that's 1908. He gets it a few years later. He gets it later because he's trying to make up for the fact that in the beginning, there was something missing on his CV. So when they hire him, they realize we can't hire him as rabbi. They bring him on at $60 a month as the superintendent of the cheder. With the caveat that if he does a good job, after a few months, we'll hire him as the minister. The minister.
Shamus.
Now, minister is not shamus. Shamus is low down on the ranking. Minister is the equivalent of like the British minister of the United Synagogue congregations. Spanish Portuguese has that term, but their rabbis were real rabbis. But like in England, where only the chief rabbi had smicha, all the other ministers of United Synagogue shuls were graduates of Jews College who had a diploma but not real smicha. So they were going to hire him as minister. Well, he does a good job, so they hire him. Comes High Holidays 1904. What happens? He's ready to give, big sermons, the full house, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. No. They bring in Rabbi David Wilofsky, the Ridbaz, who wrote a parish in the Yerushalmi, a big, famous scholar, Eastern European rabbinical scholar, who was in America just to raise money for the publication of his parish on the Yerushalmi. And he was famous for saying that America is the treif of Medina, where even the stones are treif. Oive. So would he agree to serve at the same pulpit as Mordechai Kaplan? Now, Kaplan is no heretic. Kaplan is perceived to be an Orthodox clergyman who just happened to be a graduate of the seminary and speaks English. So the Ritbaz was accommodating enough to agree to sit on the same pulpit as the guy. But there could be no English language sermons while he was in the room. Now, that's a big affront to Kaplan, who's been hired as the leader of the congregation, the Mor Diaspora, the spiritual leader, whatever you want to call it. And he's being snubbed. So he didn't take it very well.
But what about the congregation? Didn't they want an English language?
So the congregation is torn between the desire on the one hand to satisfy their Americanized congregants, and on the other to have the prestige of a big old world gadol sitting on the bima at Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. There's a certain allure to that. Okay, so it's a one-time deal, over and done with. But the next year, with Kaplan being the minister of the congregation, but still not really a full rabbi, and still this desire for a prestigious, long-bearded, old-world rabbi, they hire the Ramaz, Rabbi Moshe Zvulun Margulies, who had been the chief rabbi of Boston and was a recognized Gadol BaTorah. He finished Shas, both Bavli and Yerushalmi, every year. Rabbi Luchstein told me that his great-grandfather would make a siyum for Tanis Bechorim, not on a Masechta, on Shas, every year, Erev Pesach. All right, so he was a big gadol. So would he function well with a guy like Kaplan? And no one's ever a little gadol. So that's like there's no such thing as a bad Ribbono Shel Olam. So will they get along? And the answer is they actually did. The Ramaz, for all of his credentials as a Eastern European gadol, was able to get along with an American minister. He was enough of...
Did he speak English?
Yes, he spoke English fairly well. He picked it up along the way.
He was in England for
Boston? No, well, he was in Boston, so he learned it from the Red Sox. Okay, so the answer is... If you asked anyone on the street in 1905, they'd say yes. But they weren't reading his diaries. Privately, he was already diverging from the traditional path. What turned him off to the religion? One, biblical criticism. He rejected the revelation of Sinai and Mosaic authorship of the Torah. Number two, his study of sociology and philosophy. He began to see all religion through humanistic terms and believed that religion served a useful purpose in the existence of man, but it's entirely man-made. The other factor is he began to deny the chosenness of Israel. He saw the Jewish experience as being worthy of preservation by Jews, but not because it's supernaturally revealed, or for that matter, even necessarily better than anybody else's, but because each culture is sort of duty-bound to preserve its own. And he's firmly attached to Judaism as a Jew and as a rabbi, but not for matters of conventional belief. Okay, but nobody knows that right now because he's not telling anyone. Because if you're a rabbi at KJ and you say that from the pulpit, what happens? You get fired. Okay, so that leads him to being an emotional wreck. He's uncomfortable in his own skin because he knows that he's leading a double life. He's effectively lying to his own flock. He said that davening three times a day was monotonous and impossible for him, and sometimes he'd have to stop for a few days in order to avoid getting nauseous when he said Shmona Esrei. Now, that's in his own diary, he says this. By the way, his diary lasts from 1914 to 1972, and it's the longest running diary in human history.
Wow.
27 thick volumes.
What's his personal life?
Well, he's a single guy during his KJ years until 1908 he gets married, and then he has four children, four daughters. So.
That's why I had to be a rabbi. I had to make those weddings.
Had to make the wedding. And I had to make bat mitzvahs too, which we'll get to in a second. He invented it. So, in 1909, he walks away from the pulpit of KJ. Why? He's 28 years old, recently married, all right, pregnant wife. Why is he walking away from a prestigious pulpit?
Did he get the smicha then?
He had the smicha. He just got it a year ago. So getting the smicha looks like he intends on having a career in the Orthodox rabbinate.
He's not marketable then.
Well, he's making a nice salary. He's making a very nice salary. He's earning double what the Ramaz was making. Think about that. The Godel B'Torah is making $1,200 a year, and the young whippersnapper is making $2,500 a year.
Wow. Huh?
No, Joseph Lookstein is the grandson-in-law of the Ramaz. Yeah.
He was waiting in the wings at that particular.
No, Joseph Lookstein was 7 years old at the time.
It's still waiting. Yeah.
Okay, so he walks away. Those who were there at the time did not think, even for a split second, that a man is walking away from a prestigious pulpit because he has inner struggles with his religiosity. They have no reason to think that. There's been no outward sign of that. So to what do they attribute his resignation? Answer, simply, he's going into academia. Not everyone is cut out for the pulpit. Some people were meant to go into academia. What position does he get? Well, he gets the job from Solomon Schechter, hired as the head of the Teachers Institute of the Jewish Theological Seminary. It seems like a perfect job for him because he was involved in outreach and in education. From his early days as an intern in the Jewish Endeavor Society, he ran the Cheder of KJ. He knows what he's doing. Pedagogy is his area of expertise. He may not be proficient in all of Shas and Poskim, but he's an American rabbi who knows pedagogy and knows how to deal with the rising generation of American Jews. So it's a good fit. Also, a year later, Schechter does him one more favor and appoints him as professor of homiletics. The professor of homiletics means you teach the yeshiva, the rabbinical students, how to give a sermon. In theory, this is just a technical expertise that is passed along to students. And for example, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein taught me, 13, 14 years ago in Reitz, and he's, for many, many decades, he was the professor of homiletics. And before that, his father was the professor of homiletics. So Kaplan was a professor of homiletics at the seminary. But Kaplan didn't view it that way. It wasn't just how to structure a sermon. It was also what is the content of the sermon. He turned the position into a position of substantive knowledge. Just like you learn Gemara, just like you learn Chumash, you learn homiletics. And in that fashion, he was able to not brainwash, but theologically influence 35 years worth of seminary graduates from 1910 to 1945. And during that time, he was the most formidable influence on all the students at JTS, even more so than his biggest competitor, Louis Ginsberg, who far outstripped him in knowledge. Because sometimes it's not the Gadol who influences the students, it's the one who's most charismatic or has the most significant message for the time. And that was certainly Kaplan in the teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, early 40s.
JTS was very traditional.
It was, and Kaplan became sort of the outcast at a certain point because he was theologically and then practically less frum than the others. All right. So, he's working for Schechter, and then in 1913, when the United Synagogue is founded, he becomes the vice president of the United Synagogue, which is trying to amalgamate all the traditional but not necessarily Orthodox synagogues. So he's in a seemingly a world that is not the Orthodox world, and yet he never left the Orthodox world. How did he not leave? Answer, they loved him, the Orthodox. They couldn't get enough of him, especially the rich ones. And so whether it was in Long Branch or Tannersville, or Auvergne. In the summer, if you're a fancy city Jew, you go to a vacation spot, and you stay there for 3 months. And when you're there, you want to have a shul. And if you're going to have a shul, you want to have a rabbi. And if you're going to have a rabbi, you want to have a prestigious rabbi. Who are you going to get? Mordechai Kaplan. The fact that he's beginning to say certain things that are running afoul of the traditional doctrine, yeah, well, who's reading those things anyway? They're in the Maccabean, or the Menorah Journal, or the American Hebrew. Oh, I didn't read that article, so I don't know that he's an apikoros. In other words, it's not like today with the internet, everyone knows everything. Back then, either you were reading regularly all the publications, and you were up to date as to who thinks what, or you were indifferent to all that stuff, and you just knew that Kaplan was a prestigious rabbi, and we want to have him for the summer. Moreover, KJ didn't give up on him. He came back to KJ from 1909 to 1917 on many occasions, including as late as the high holidays of 1917, where he delivered sermons on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Now, the reason why they kept bringing him back, he wanted the money, he needed kesef, but also KJ had a hard time finding a suitable English language replacement. The Ramaz was there for 30 years, from 1905 until his death in 1936. But they wanted an English language minister as well. With Kaplan resigned, it took 4 years to find someone. They found Herbert Goldstein. But Herbert Goldstein didn't last long there because he moved to the West Side Institutional. Well, first Harlem Institutional and then the West Side Institutional. So Goldstein was only there for a few years. They needed someone. They called Kaplan back to come for the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. They didn't get a good quality English language minister until Joe Lookstein married the Ramaz's granddaughter and was hired as the assistant rabbi in 1923. And then the Lookstein family held on to that shul for the next 90 years after that. Yeah.
Did he ever get pushback from any of the
congregants? Okay. So the answer to that is yes, but not until the Jewish Center period, when we get the real battle royal between the frummies and the non-frummies. Yeah. Class of 1911, 1913.
And he got smirfa from Orthodox.
Yes.
And he was an agudist.
Yes. He wasn't in the world of the Mizrahi. He was an agudist, which was a rarity. That's a very odd thing that a man who graduated from the seminary had the career path that he did. But he was a very important figure in American Orthodoxy, with the benefit of having a very wealthy father-in-law, Harry Fischel, who could fund his various endeavors. Okay, so getting back to Kaplan. In 1917, Kaplan has an idea. It's not a new idea, and it's not exclusively his idea. He spent the last 8 years involved in education, working for Salman Schechter in various capacities, working for the United Synagogue, being a summertime rabbi, being a high holiday rabbi, being generally a public intellectual. He worked with the New York Keilah and Judah Magnus, which was a catch-all group for the educational projects in New York City, before Magnus went on to become the president of the Hebrew University. But he wants to build one institution which will be a Beit Tefillah, a Beit Midrash, and a Beit Am, or a Beit Knesset. So, religious, educational, and social, cultural activities all in one house. One building, a Jewish center. He wants to build that. But it takes money. It takes resources. And where is it going to happen? It's going to happen on the West Side. Why the West Side and not the East Side? Because anybody who was anybody moved from the East Side to the West Side from the late teens through the early 20s. So much so that the East Side, not that it was Judenrein, but the prestigious people were leaving. That two little historical tidbits, not related to Kaplan, but I'll just throw in for the fun of it. In 1922, the East Side prestigious Jewish population had been so dwindling that there was talk of knocking down Zichron Ephraim, which became Park East, and turning it into a parking lot. The other thing is, by the 1930s, the East Side was so lacking in a critical mass of Jews that when the Ramaz died, and Rabbi Joe Lookstein was going to take over the pulpit of KJ, he seriously considered and applied for a job in Southfield, Michigan. And he lost that race to Rabbi Morris Adler. And Baruch Hashem for Rabbi Lookstein that he lost that race, because what happened to Morris Adler? He was assassinated at his own pulpit. The only rabbi in American Jewish history ever to be shot and killed in shul by a disgruntled ex-bar mitzvah boy. No, it was. I don't think it was Yom Kippur. Was it Yom Kippur? Maybe. It was 1966. Yeah. 1966, yes. Okay. I don't know. Conservative shul, yeah. Okay, so...
Is there a news article about that?
Yeah, sure. The shooter was Richard Stephen Wisniewski. You can look it up. Morris Adler and Wisniewski. You'll look at it. 1966. Okay. So Kaplan wants to build this Jewish center. It's going to have to happen on the West Side. Well, is there a shul on the West Side? The answer is that there are some little shtiebels that exist, and there's Ohav Tzedek, which was at the time still ensconced on 116th Street with Yossele Rosenblatt. It would later move down to 95th, but south of Harlem, there really isn't much going on in terms of Orthodox houses of worship. And so the Nouveau Riche who were moving there...
What about
Sherith Israel? So Sherith Israel was built... on 70th and Central Park West in 1897, and those wealthy Jews who could stomach the Spanish-Portuguese-style service would go there for lack of a better option, but did they really want to have what was foreign to them? They wanted an Ashkenazic synagogue. And so therefore, a couple of the heavy hitters, including Joseph Cohen and William Fishman and a few other important industrialists, put together the money and the willpower to start this Jewish center between Columbus and Amsterdam on West 86.
Was this initiated by...
So Kaplan was involved from the very beginning, although it was far from certain that he would be the rabbi of the shul. He was a guiding light of the whole project, but there were problems from the beginning because it was going to be an Orthodox synagogue, but these fellows knew that Kaplan was no longer an Orthodox rabbi. They knew that his personal feelings were no longer what they had been when he was on KJ 15 years previous.
Was he doing anything personally that tipped them off?
He wrote on Shabbos in his diary, but years later, and nobody knew that. So the answer is no. The answer is no. He was careful not to violate the norms of American Jewish life for a traditional rabbi, which means that, you know, his wife didn't cover her hair and he was shaking hands with women. That's what was the standard in those years. Did he carry outside the Eruv? I don't know. There was no Eruv. Did people know from carrying back then? It's a chumrah. The point is, he behaved in the manner that was consistent for a rabbi of his standing. He didn't tip anybody off in personal behavior.
So what did they know?
They knew from public statements of his, questioning the revelation, questioning the continued validity of mitzvot, even the ones that he personally observed, questioning the chosenness of Israel, questioning a whole host of dogmas, but he did so very often in an evasive way. He would never say, this is what I believe. He would say, this is what some people believe. A very Trump-esque, you know, people are saying.
This Jewish center is the Jewish center on 86.
Yes. Okay, so it's inaugurated in January of 1918 because a wealthy Macher's son had bar mitzvah that Shabbos, and even though the building wasn't finished, they had services. So he becomes the rabbi. He doesn't take a salary. They want to pay him. They want to pay him $12,000 a year. He doesn't want to take it at first. It's a fortune, yes.
At first.
He later does take a salary by 1920. He's working at JTS. So the shul is up and running. It's attracting members. Are the members personally quite observant? For the most part, no. Which serves Kaplan in good stead, because it means that if he does start opening his mouth, then he's not going to offend them. But he had a deal with the original leadership of the synagogue that he would do nothing in his public statements to bring disgrace or shame upon the congregation. In other words, you can personally think whatever you want, and you can even say things that are a little bit heterodox, but don't go over the line and embarrass us. That was the deal. A deal like that is subject to a lot of interpretation. What's considered over the line? What's considered embarrassing? In 1920, Kaplan establishes the Society for the Jewish Renaissance and begins to openly say things that previously he held back and only thought to himself. This gets the Jewish Center in trouble. The leaders of the Agudas Rabbanim and Reitz and other stalwart Orthodox organizations begin to question the orthodoxy of the Jewish Center. And for the founding members, who themselves might not have been so observant, but didn't want to have their orthodoxy questioned, they now realize Kaplan is a problem, we have to get rid of him. But if we get rid of him, we're going to lose half the membership. And if we lose half the membership, the building is on a mortgage and we can't pay it. So financially, we're stuck. We have to have a theological compromise out of fiscal necessity. Okay, so Kaplan wants a sabbatical. He wants a year off to pursue other endeavors. And his opponents don't want the sabbatical. They want him gone. His advocates would like to keep him happy, but they're afraid that if he leaves, he's never coming back. So everybody is in a state of turmoil. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And this lasts for a year and a half. Very long and angry and acrimonious board meetings. Finally, in January of 1922, Kaplan resigns. but he conspired with a significant part of the membership to resign their membership simultaneous with his resignation as the rabbi and establish on that very same day the Society for the Advancement of Judaism, which would be established one block from the Jewish Center between Central Park West and Columbus on West 86th Street. So, now, the SAJ...
That's also still there.
Still there, still there. The SAJ would be a pulpit at which Kaplan was free to say whatever he wanted. He could espouse Reconstructionist Judaism from that pulpit. He also could tinker with the service and establish the bat mitzvah for his daughter Judith, who would go on to marry his successor, Ira Eisenstein. That was an example of a man with limited talent, I think, who married well and did, you know, elevated himself in the world of the rabbinate. Now, what happens next? So, he's an open heretic with a shul one block away from his former shul. He seems to be out of the orbit of Orthodox life. But no, because he never fully leaves. You see, the Jewish Center had problems, financial problems, during the Depression, between 1929 and 1932. And there was talk about closing down. But then there was talk about rejoining together with SAJ and making one shul out of two buildings and getting rid of Kaplan's Jewish Center's successor, who was Leo Jung. Now, wait a second. How could a shul fire Rabbi Jung, an Orthodox rabbi, an Orthodox synagogue, and bring back the man they used to have but they got rid of a decade earlier for heresy, for rank heresy, just because they're a few dollars short in the budget? Well, the answer is the few dollars short in the budget wins out over everything, possibly. Okay, you know, it didn't happen. In the end, it didn't work out that way. SAJ remained separate, Jewish Center remained separate. Rabbi Jung went on to have a long, illustrious career, and Kaplan went his own way. But
would he have had anybody else than Rabbi Jung, something else could have developed? Because Jung was a big personality, even at his early stages of his career.
Yes, yes, he was a force to be reckoned with.
A big force,
but he also was an Agudist.
He also was an but that made sense because he came from Hungary, and then was in England, and then he came to New York. As opposed to Goldstein, who was a seminary guy. But yeah, they were both Agudists, unlike almost everyone else in the modern Orthodox rabbinate, who was Mizrahi. So, yeah.
What is the belief structure of Reconstruction?
Okay. So Reconstructionism is based upon the Bible, this Bible. Judaism as a Civilization, Toward a Reconstruction of American Jewish Life, published in 1934.
Who wrote it?
Mordechai Kaplan. So, Kaplan was 53 years old at that time and had yet to publish a significant work. Most public thinkers, by the age of 53, have already produced much of what they're going to produce and have laid out their platform. But he was a late bloomer in that respect. He was more of a doer and less of a writer in his early years. But since he lived to 102, he had plenty of years left to write. So he wrote this book and then five more, which elaborated upon it. Reconstructionism sees Judaism as a civilization which is multifaceted, where religion plays a role but not the predominant role, and that language and ethnic folkways and even a degree of nationalism are all important components. It denies any supernaturalism, so there's no personal God, which is his biggest heresy. Instead of a personal God, what is God? God is the process that leads to salvation. In other words, the force in the world that impels us to be good. That is God. Can you pray to that? I can pray to an idol if I'm a pagan. I can pray to an incorporeal God if I'm a Maimonidean Jew. But can I pray to a process? That's what the critics of Kaplan would argue. You can't. Therefore, it's not religion. It's bogus. And that was his sharpest attacks were on that point. But he was a staunch Zionist, a spiritual Zionist in the vein of Achad Ha'am, not of Herzlian Zionism, but of spiritual cultural Zionism, which means that he believes that the center of Eretz Yisrael should be espousing Hebrew literature, Hebrew culture, and that the light from the center in Israel should shine forth to the chutz la'aretz, the diaspora. So he's not one of these people who are b'shtilat ha'galut, negation of the diaspora. He believes in a strong diaspora, but a strong diaspora where Jews no longer believe what they used to believe. They still observe in good measure, but not for the same reasons. For reasons of perpetuating our culture that has inherent value, religion aside. Okay.
Do they believe any halacha, resmilo,
okay. So as we discussed Louis Jacob's criticism of the Reform and the Reconstructionist was that the Reform rabbi thinks kosher and eats treif, and the Reconstructionist rabbi thinks treif and eats kosher. That Kaplanian Judaism encourages you to keep kosher, go to shul on Shabbos, daven in Hebrew, study Torah, put on tefillin, wear a talis, keep your head covered with a yarmulke. Ceremonial Judaism is good. Not to an extreme, not to examine the Esrog with a microscope, but good ceremonial Judaism, which is exactly the opposite of neo-reform, a classical reform, which was abolishing ceremonial Judaism left and right. So Kaplan is taking non-orthodoxy in a very different direction. Okay, so let's now, before we discuss the substance of his critique in this book of other denominations, just finish off the story of his life. In 1941, he publishes a Haggadah, the Reconstructionist Haggadah, which departs from the tradition considerably in that he's no longer believing in the Exodus narrative and the theophany of Sinai as a good traditional Jew would. And so, of course, the traditionalists were aghast. How could you say such things? Then in 1945, he published a Siddur. And the Agudas Rabbanim burned it. Okay, now this is a very famous episode and requires clarification. It was at the McAlpin Hotel in April of 1945, a convention of the Agudas Rabbanim, and they put Kaplan in Cheirim, officially put him in Cheirim, and they burned a copy of his Siddur. The fact that this happened in April of 1945, at the end of the Holocaust, when the Nazis had just been burning Jewish books, didn't sit well with the larger Jewish public. Now, technically speaking, were they correct halachically in burning his book? So the halacha is that if an apikoros writes a Sefer Torah, what do you do to it? Even with the Shemos, you burn it. Okay, so technically speaking, this was the correct way to do it, but it's unseemly by 20th century standards. So what was the reaction? So the professors at JTS wrote a letter in Hadoar, the Hebrew language weekly in New York. And the professors who signed this letter were Louis Ginsberg, Saul Lieberman, and Alexander Marx, the three most traditional members of the faculty. And they said to Kaplan, Malacha etzel halacha, klach etzel agada. Now, who knows from Gemara where that's taken from? What's the original? So the original is what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said to Rabbi Akiva. Certain rabbis were great halachists, and certain rabbis were great agadists. Elazar ben Azariah was a great homilist, a great agadist. Rabbi Akiva was the expert halachist. So what? Rabbi Akiva gave a sermon one day, a homiletic sermon, and it totally fell flat. It was a bad drasha, bad sermon, by everybody's account. And so what does Elazar ben Azariah tell him? Malacha etzel agada. Why are you getting involved in homiletics? Klach lacha etzel negayim v'ohalot. Stick to tent impurities and saras. In other words, you know the minutiae of halacha better than anyone else in the world. You, Rabbi Akiva. So stick to what you know, and I'll do the sermonizing. So the seminary professors flipped it on its head. Kaplan, you're the professor of homiletics. So malacha etzel halacha. Why are you getting involved in liturgy or halachic matters? That's not your field. Stick to homiletics. It's a shtach. It's putting him in his place. Now, the Agudas Rabbanim responded to that letter saying, no, he's an outright heretic. He shouldn't have any place in halacha or agada. Kick him out of Judaism altogether. But it wasn't the place of faculty members to say such a thing. Now, so he had a big following in the seminary, but Yesh Omrim, some say, and I have a reason to believe this is true, because someone who saw it happen told me years later that Lieberman, who was a very frum man, he followed the Cheirim, the Agudas Rabbanim. And when someone's a Cheirim, you can't go within a Dalat Amos of them, 4 cubits, which is about 6 feet. So when Kaplan was in the elevator, Lieberman would take the stairs. he adhered to the chair and wouldn't go within 6 feet of the guy.
But other Reconstruction is when he is blind,
yeah.
Do they have any shul?
Oh, the answer is no. Reconstructionism as a movement never really took off. And the reason it didn't is it didn't have to. Because Kaplan's influence was in the conservative movement. And this requires, it's going to take us a little bit past 9:15, because this is my area of interest. From 1927 to 1948, the conservative movement had what we would what they called the Committee on Jewish Law. The Rabbinical Assembly had their Vad HaHalacha, the Committee on Jewish Law. And it was run...
That still exists.
Okay, in a modified form. That's the key point. From 27 to 48, it was run by members of the seminary faculty who were very traditional. Louis Ginzburg, and then Boaz Cohen, one of my heroes, one of the great unheralded people of 20th century Judaism, Boaz Cohen. And they didn't allow for too many innovations. The only thing that they sort of bidiavad allowed was mixed seating. But all other tinkering with the halacha was disapproved. Then in 1948, after a very hectic convention at the Concord Hotel, the left wing defeated the right wing. And the Committee on Jewish Law was abolished and was replaced with the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. What is a standard? A standard is something that you make up. It's your standard. But it's not the law. The law is something that is extrapolated from the traditional sources, as best you might interpret it. But a standard is admittedly your own mishigas. It's your standard. Maybe not somebody else's, but yours. And so conservative Judaism from 1948 going forward was free to innovate in their version of the halakha in a very, you know, radical ways. The most important being in 1950 they allowed to drive to shul on Shabbos. In 1969, solving the aguna problem through various methods of undoing marriages. So Kaplan was the force behind the departure from strict Jewish law to Jewish law and standard, which gives you a lot more wiggle room. Okay. So, in 1945, he retires as professor of homiletics. In 1963, he retires as the head of the Teachers Institute. In 1963, he retires as professor of homiletics. And he's basically an old man who's out of the picture. But, in 1968, the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Seminary is founded in Philadelphia, with him as sort of the patron saint. He's not really involved because he's 87 years old at that point and is retired. And maybe he's writing a few books or articles every now and then. And in the summer, he goes up to upstate to Camp Sedgwin, where my father had the privilege of studying under him in 1969. It was like across the pond from Woodstock. So that's his later years, where he's sort of over the hill. He moves to Israel in 1972, at the age of 91, stops writing his diary, comes back in 1980 to live out his last years in the Riverdale Hebrew home, and dies in 1983 at the age of 102. Okay, just a few little tidbits. In 1976, YU was 90 years old, and some PR person had this idea, let's find the oldest alumni of YU. Until they found out it was Mordechai Kaplan, they crushed the idea. All right. There's another story, and this is totally apocryphal. I doubt this happened, but it's a story that is told. I'm not making this up. So even if it never happened, it says something. It's a medrash. Rabbi Jung, who would avoid him on the street for decades, if they saw each other on 86th Street, they would cross to the other side to avoid contact, wanted to bury the hatchet when Morty was in the Hebrew home at the age of 101 in 1982. And Jung himself was an old man. And he goes to visit him, and legend has it, he asks, "New Morty, what was the secret to your longevity?" And he responds, "My longevity? I believed in nothing, so nothing ever bothered me." Now, it may never have happened, but the reason why the story is humorous is because it's true. He believed in nothing. He eliminated all the theological components of Judaism. Okay. Yeah. So now let's go to the fun part, where he criticizes everybody else. The Bas Mitzvah was established in 1922 for his daughter Judith, and it didn't take off right away. Bat Mitzvah, even in the conservative synagogues, was not really a popular thing until the 1950s. But the idea existed, and therefore it was something that eventually could be adopted, even by Orthodox synagogues by the 1970s.
How did it spread to Orthodoxy? I mean, to, you know, five towns Orthodoxy.
I don't have a good answer for that. All I can say is that a component of it is the jump from traditional conservative synagogues of the immediate post-war era to an Orthodox synagogue by the 1980s by the same people. In other words, people who experienced traditional conservative Judaism in the 1950s and early 60s, including girls who had bat mitzvahs themselves, but who subsequently joined Orthodox synagogues and sent their children to day school a generation later, would have known about it because they personally went through it and may have liked it and actively encouraged it for the next generation.
I think the caterers
also are involved, yeah.
I think seriously, though, when I was growing up, it wasn't a bat mitzvah. It was a sweet 16.
Exactly. Yeah. And that fell out of favor.
That fell out of favor culturally
in America in general.
When did they change it to 13? Oh,
in the 1990s. In the 1990s, it was changed to 13 by the conservative movement because they wanted to equalize gender equality. Yeah. Okay. All right. So Kaplan's book is 500 pages. Nobody reads all 500 pages anymore. Not even the historians read all 500 pages. I read it the cover to cover because my professor forced me to, but for our purposes, the only thing that matters is not what his own theories, but his
professor for that?
Jeffrey Gurak. So, which is interesting, because Joe Luxdean, who taught sociology at Yeshiva College in the 1940s, assigned this to his students, Oive, and the students objected. And he had to convince them that there is a usable Kaplan, that Kaplan, the man, may be a heretic, but he has what to offer the Orthodox world. His sociological analysis is on target and therefore worthy of being studied. 30 years later, Jeff Gurak, 1976, is teaching the Bernard Revel Graduate School. He's a young professor. He's a young man, 27 years old at the time. His first time teaching, first day on the job, in room 301 in the back of Muss Hall, okay? And he assigns Judaism as a civilization on the syllabus. One of his students, who was simultaneously in Reitz, as were most of the students in Revel in those years, says, I can't read this. This is Usser. Can't read this. So they talk for a half hour about why it's important and how, as an historical document, it's important, even if the man is a heretic. And bear in mind, Kaplan was still alive at the time. So the student finally breaks down and says, fine, I'll read it, only in fulfillment of the dictum of Pirkei Avos, da masher tashiv l'apikoros. Know how to respond to a heretic, not for the inherent value of the book. Okay, so he critiques Reform. He starts off by saying that Reform Judaism is wrong about a lot of things, but it's better than nothing. He says it in highfalutin language, but basically you can boil it down to, it's better than nothing. And that the reformers, the early reformers, were not looking to destroy. They were looking to preserve, but they no longer believed in the traditional fashion, so it was incumbent upon them to create new justifications for the preservation of Judaism, and their work product was just not all that impressive. They were trying their best, but they just didn't do a good job. Now, he acknowledges that pre-modern Judaism was overly emphasizing ritualism, and that Reform was, in his mind, correct in downplaying the significance of ritualism, but they went too far such that whatever Jewish morality or beliefs they wished to preserve no longer had a shell of a community in which to preserve it. Meaning, if you don't keep ceremonial acts, then what makes your synagogue a synagogue as opposed to just an empty room? And that's his point. They went too far in making their Judaism devoid of substance. That's a question. Now, he then says that reformism has not succeeded in enabling Judaism to survive more than two or at most three generations. So he gives an expiration date to Reform Judaism. Was he right or was he wrong about that? So he was wrong. He was absolutely wrong.
From what?
So why is he wrong? Because Reform Judaism is able to survive
on the arrival of people downgrading religiously over time. He may be correct in assessing how far one family can perpetuate its own Reform Judaism, but not how long the institutions of Reform Judaism can continue to exist, to have have operational success.
So you're saying there's really a rotation of membership?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Now, his next criticism is, Reform Judaism is only for the upper class, or the upper middle class, at most. He's right about that. He felt very strongly that those American Jews who don't achieve prosperity still need a reasonable non-Orthodox religion to fall back upon. And it can't be Reform with their big cathedrals and high-paid rabbis and fancy choirs. It's just not going to work out. And on that point, he was very, very much on target, because we lose sight of the fact that many people are outpriced from Judaism. They just can't make it. His next point.
By the way, Hasbro makes it economically more.
Yes, it has, by eliminating dues in certain places, by making things optional, not just optional in terms of mitzvahs, but optional in terms of payments. That you can take advantage, you can function as a member of a synagogue without such a heavy fiscal commitment. In some places, not in all places. In my neck of the woods, you pay a pretty penny. That's why some of them come to my shul. We have the cheapest dues in town. So, now, one of his biggest problems with Reform is they have no solution to the problem of theodicy and evil. They just don't have a solution. Reform Judaism is happy-go-lucky and doesn't want to think about all the negativity in the world. And he has very trenchant words. He says, in other words, we are called upon to be martyrs for a religion which fails in its raison d'etre, that of enabling us to adjust ourselves constructively to the evil in ourselves and in the world. That Reform Judaism believed in the ability of man to perfect himself. The rationalism of the Enlightenment and of the 19th century thought that everything was going in a positive trajectory. Well, the 1930s and the Holocaust proved that that was very wrong. And although this is written in 1934, before the Shoah, already Hitler is in power, and Reform is struggling to come up with an answer to, you know, why were we wrong about the direction of mankind? Okay. He has a very funny little piece here. He says that the conception of religion was changed by the Reformers. It was as though a family were to organize itself into a philosophical society. That by saying we're no longer a nation, that Jews are citizens of their host country, and there no longer is Am Yisrael. They took away the national existence of Jewry. That was a key pillar of Reformism. So he says, they turn us from a family to a philosophical society. And he says, sociologically, such an organism is absurd. From its very nature, it cannot function. Correct. So in response to what was going on in Europe, and in response to Kaplan's success as a public intellectual, the Columbus Platform of 1937 overturned the Pittsburgh Platform of 1885 and said that Zionism is okay, and that Hebrew is okay, and some mitzvah observance is okay. It was neo-reform as opposed to classical reform, with a heavy dose of Kaplan-style Judaism influencing it.
That seems to go counter to the other religions. For example, Roman Catholics do have, I think, an affinity toward Rome, or the Eastern sects.
Towards also. Yeah. It's true. You're right.
So they're the only ones, I would think, in the Western cultures.
It's the product of Jews having been denied political freedom for many centuries, and in the hopes of securing it, throwing away a significant part of your own religious heritage, namely the national component, thinking that it was incompatible with modern day citizenship. Okay. Now there's a little funny paragraph here. Suppose there were an immigration law to the effect that if a number of members of one family wanted to gain admission into the country at the same time, they should not be permitted to enter. Let us say that the name of the family was Cohen, which had not heard of the law, and they happened to arrive. What is to be done? One of them hits an idea in his head. From now on, they shall no longer regard themselves as a family. Their status shall henceforth be that of a society, but a society must have a purpose. That purpose shall be the practice of Cohenism. coming together periodically and performing the ritual blessing of the world. In that way, the immigration law can be circumvented. Such, practically, has been a procedure of reformism on the question of Jewish nationhood. In other words, they made a mishigas. They said, instead of being a people, a family of Jews, we are just a society that gathers together for a particular purpose. Ridiculous. That's his way of mocking reformism. Well, that's why it's a society. Okay. Now, one thing that really bothered him was the fact that Reform Judaism, to use a modern expression, is a nothing burger. There's no there. There's no meat or potatoes. And he says like this: in the old days, Jews studied Torah, and there's a lot of Torah, a lot of books on the shelf. It takes you forever, a whole lifetime. Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam. Reform, what is there? He says, the traditional four L's of the law represented a lifelong educational process. Reformist Judaism has not enough content to occupy children for a few years, 60 hours a year in Hebrew school. In other words, 30 weeks a year, the school year, 2 hours a week on Sunday for a few years. There isn't that much to learn, and they're going to have dead time to have recess and play handball because there's not enough to learn. They've abolished too much. That's his criticism. Okay. What's his criticism of the Orthodox? So his criticism of the Orthodox is basically that unless you're going to accept traditional concepts of revelation, neo-Orthodoxy, as he puts it, will not be satisfactory to you. Moreover, he says that neo-Orthodoxy is bogus, because in fact, they themselves have abolished a significant portion of the law. Which portion of the law? Choshen Mishpat. That's his argument. That since Jews no longer follow Choshen Mishpat, civil law, according to the Torah, what's to stop us from abolishing Yoredeya, or for that matter, Evan Ezer?
Where did we get that idea?
Okay, so the answer is that it is in the Hagdama to one of the Vilna printed editions of the Shulchan Aruch, that basically says we no longer follow the Choshen Mishpat anymore. That in Russia or in whatever Western country, we follow Dina de Malchus Adina, and all this is irrelevant. So, is that true? It depends who you ask. In certain cultures, in certain parts of the Orthodox world today, Choshen Mishpat is very important, and we want to go to Beis Din. But the reality for Western Orthodoxy was not that at all. They went to civil courts.
We saw Ribbis today.
And who's following Ribbis carefully? That's his argument. The argument is that the people who claim to be so-called neo-Orthodox are in their personal lives not careful about a whole section of Jewish law. Why? Forget why. The point is it's a fact. And so there could be more facts, like we're getting rid of another section and another section. He's pointing out the inconsistency of a school of thought that says Torah, 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 Mi-Sinai, absolute, when in fact it's not so absolute. Now, that's his criticism. His other point is about conservative Judaism. He's writing in the 1930s. Conservative Judaism as a movement really doesn't exist yet. I mean, its institutions exist, but really as a movement, it's not off the ground. And he says there are two conservative Judaisms. There is left-wing and right-wing. The left-wing are really just Reform Jews who want to do more mitzvahs, who believe in the Reform fashion, rejecting the traditional concepts of revelation, but who don't want to abolish wholesale all the ceremonial laws. They want to hear shofar on Rosh Hashanah, they want to shake a lulav and esrog, they want to eat matzah in Shmurah Matzah, they want to do mitzvot, and they believe in God, but they don't believe in traditional concepts of revelation. So he says that's a very weak approach. Why? Because there's really nothing differentiating that between radical reform. It's just a matter of degree, and who's to say one is better than the other. The right-wing conservative, he said, believes, like the Orthodox, in Torah Mi-Sinai. All right? Torah Min HaShemayim. But they're willing to tinker with the halacha based upon modern considerations. That's the JTS crowd of Louis Ginsburg. But he had a very important point to make. He said the right-wing conservatives are evasive when it comes to their true theological beliefs. Although they seem to be on the same page as the official Orthodox, they don't say it outright. They're a little bit wishy-washy. Now, he knows from personal experience Because for 20 years he lied to everyone about his own beliefs. And effectively he played the role of a right-wing conservative rabbi who was, maybe he's Orthodox and maybe he isn't, in matters of thinking, forget practice. Now, his point was that that right-wing conservative and the left-wing conservative will not come together as one. And on that, he was wrong. They did come together. What brought them together? Institutional loyalty. Both of those groups are seminary groups, not YU, not HUC. They're 122nd Street and Broadway. And when you learn in the same institution, and you graduate rabbis who go to the same kind of shuls, it doesn't matter whether one is a traditional believer and one is not. The bottom line is they're in the same social world. And so what ended up happening was Kaplan was proven wrong. The Orthodox are an entity unto themselves, the YU world. The Reform were an entity unto themselves, the Cincinnati world. And the conservative movement coalesced as a partnership of people who didn't think alike, but ate bread together. Yeah.
Wasn't he a little ahead of himself? And today you see the conservatives splintering off in two different directions.
Are they?
Okay, so the conservative movement today is not splitting in two different directions. It's just dying. You could argue that there was a split, that the left wing adopted Reconstructionism wholesale and, you know, abandoned their relationship with the seminary, with the United Synagogue, with the RA, and have their own Reconstructionist institutions, which never were all that important in American Jewish life, but they do exist, all right? There are Reconstructionist shuls, there are Reconstructionist rabbis.
How many are there?
Not many.
There's one here.
Yeah, where is it? On Hewlett, yeah.
Took over the...
Okay. And on the other hand, to the right side, there was the Union for Traditional Judaism. But the Union for Traditional Judaism, had about a 20-year existence, based out of Teaneck, and Professor Halivni, Admeyev Yesrim, he's still alive, he's 90 years old, but he was like a one-man show. He broke away after they started ordaining women. When Saul Lieberman died in 1983 and Gerson Cohen decided they were going to ordain women, he resigned. And certain people went with him. And that crowd has a small constituency, but it basically doesn't exist anymore. So they gravitated towards Chol Vei Torah. And there is basically no daylight between Chol Vei Torah and the UTJ. One is a successor to the other, in my opinion. Now, the Chove would deny that. They would scream and yell that I'm wrong. But I'm right and they're wrong. And well, that would stop.